Undisclosed, the Killing of Freddie Gray Episode 9 is brought to you by BloomNet and Storyworth. Make sure you listen in for the spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that, research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
In last week's episode, we talked about hard evidence, the evidence of CCTV footage that should, in theory, be neutral. But if you haven't figured it out yet, evidence is rarely neutral. Even simple data is rarely neutral. How and why it's collected, who collects it, and who has access to it all impacts what that evidence ends up looking like. And what it ends up telling us depends on who is offering the evidence. In this case, that who is the BPD. So to understand so much of what happened to Freddie Gray and others like him, we have to understand the Baltimore City Police Department and its leadership. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhry and I'm here with my colleagues, Justine Barron, Amelia McDonald-Perry, and Dr. Marcia Chatlin.
My name is Amelia McDonald-Perry and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marcia Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
Well, who's working out?
In the department? Nobody, really. I mean, we're a little busy doing street rips, you know, community policing and all that.
In this scene from the pilot episode of The Wire, homicide detective Jimmy McNulty tells a judge why nobody is going after the known drug dealers and killers running the West Side. Sarcastically, he blames zero-tolerance policing of low-level offenses. That's not community policing, right? Actually, at the time, community policing did encompass broken windows and zero-tolerance. Taking care of quality of life in communities was considered to be part of a proactive, community-oriented crime plan. McNulty's sarcasm indicates that he knows how community policing plays out in reality. All of that aggressive street ripping wasn't, in his opinion, what real police do. Debates around policing tend to involve absolute binaries that change over time. For this project, we sought to understand Baltimore policing beyond its superficial binaries and press releases. To achieve this mission, it has taken listening to police officers themselves, a lot of them, from all generations and ranks. Fortunately, cops love telling stories. It's probably an occupational hazard from writing all of those probable cause statements all day. The officers we spoke with, on and off the record, helped tell the modern history of the Baltimore Police Department. It's a huge story, but we sought to capture the pivotal moments that contributed to some of what happened around the death of Freddie Gray under the leadership of Commissioner Anthony Batts. But first, we go back more than 200 years.
If you remember the very first episode of this podcast, I mentioned that the Baltimore Police Department was established in 1784, meaning the city could rely on a group of constables to patrol the streets at night, respond to citizens in crisis, and work with leaders in the best interest of the people of Baltimore. Baltimore was a young city, and policing obviously lacked the complexity it has today, and Baltimore lacked the population it has today as well. In 1790, among the approximately 25,000 people living in Baltimore, more than a quarter of them were enslaved. Unable to seek recourse in the courts, expect protection from law enforcement, and subject to abuse or sale at any moment. In 1860, a few years before slavery was abolished in Maryland, Baltimore was home to 4,321 free blacks, 3,182 slaves, in a city of 54,000. The end of slavery was not the beginning of freedom for Black Baltimore, and while the short-lived Reconstruction efforts in the United States ushered in Black political participation, the establishment of Black schools and the strengthening of Black organizations, the ability of African Americans to serve and protect their own communities would not happen in Baltimore until 1937, when Violet Hill White was hired as the city's first Black police officer. White was a college-educated social worker who served mostly the juvenile justice beat. White and the other officers who followed in her footsteps over the next three decades found themselves serving and protecting on an unequal basis. In Baltimore, Black police officers could not wear official uniforms until around 1942. In 1947, Black patrolman James H. Butler was promoted to sergeant. He started his career as a house painter, although he always wanted to be a teacher. A graduate of then Morgan State College, Butler was among the throngs of college-educated Blacks who had to settle for whatever kind of work they could find. After spending a few years as a plainclothes detective, Butler's appointment was a sign of progress in Baltimore. And across the country in cities from Atlanta to Los Angeles, Blacks were calling upon the city to appoint more Black police officers, judges, teachers, and other public servants. In 1947, Butler told the Baltimore Sun that the most difficult arrest of his career was of a 16-year-old African-American boy, Alfonso Bowie, who was convicted of rape, attempted rape, and robbery. Butler was saddened by the boy's arrest because this was the second time he had taken Alfonso into custody. When he was 9 years old, Alfonso was arrested by Butler for stealing a purse. Butler hoped that if he befriended Alfonso, he could keep him away from a life of crime. Black police officers, like White, Butler, and the other pioneers of Black policing, often described pride in being part of law enforcement, and an unease in having to see neighbors, family, friends, and fellow Black citizens subject to systems they knew were flawed despite their best efforts. In Baltimore, the dozens of Black police officers who were able to fight their way onto the force would find themselves without more than just uniforms. Firearms were withheld from Black police officers until 1950, and access to patrol cars wouldn't come into the 1960s. And increasingly, it was clear that Black police officers didn't have the authority always to arrest whites, and they could find themselves victims of police racism inside and outside their precincts. Then everything changed. Well, it was supposed to change. The convergence of the civil rights movement, the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and local campaigns for more Black police officers after civil unrest troubled the nation throughout the 1960s, ushered in an era of police reforms and initiatives that took seriously the need for Black police officers to come from Black communities and respond to the crises of Black America, particularly the growing instability of large cities, which were showing the signs of decades of economic disinvestment, unemployment, and police brutality. After the Holy Week uprising, the approximately 1 week response to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4, 1968, the Maryland Crime Investigation Committee echoed the conclusions of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorder, also known as the Kerner Commission, as they looked at unrest unfolding in Detroit and mirrored the sentiments of the 1965 study inspired by unrest in Watts, entitled Violence in the City, An End or a Beginning? Baltimore's uprisings could be subverted, they reasoned, by the help of Black police officers. Among the list of steps Baltimore could take to prevent another civil eruption, the commission suggested that the police commissioner ensure, quote, more adequate police protection to be provided to the ghetto residents to eliminate their high sense of insecurity and the belief of many Negro citizens in the existence of a dual standard of law enforcement. Better educate the citizen in the ghetto of the procedure for bringing against the police and other municipal employees complaints. Recruit more Negroes into the regular police force and continue to review police promotion policies to ensure fair promotion for Negro officers and recruit more ghetto youth into the Baltimore Cadet Program. The junior officers could perform duties in the ghetto neighborhoods but would not have full police authority. Black police organizations like Philadelphia's Guardian Civic League, Chicago's Afro-American Patrolmen's League, and Baltimore's Vanguard Justice Society in conjunction with civil rights groups, agitated to integrate police forces with varying success. While the Fraternal Order of Police, the nation's largest police organization, and its head, John Harrington, was endorsing segregationist George Wallace in the 1968 presidential election, these leagues and societies were trying to engender trust in police in Black communities while trying to reform police departments from the inside. The FOP, which also endorsed the current president in the 2016 presidential election, has been and can still find itself at odds with 12% of the nation's officers who have to contend with serving while Black. All of these attempts to change policing, the suggestions, the recruitment, the visibility of Black officers in communities seemed promising. But if you read the newspaper from the 1960s and these commission findings, you realize something troubling. Considering that everyone agreed that in Black neighborhoods and cities as diverse as Los Angeles, Chicago, Miami, Detroit, and New York City all struggled with unemployment, substandard yet expensive housing, and a lack of political representation in key areas, policing was always front and center as a solution. But policing can't be offered to answer all problems, and a more diverse police force meant little for the material conditions of the poor and the marginalized. So the 1960s was a bittersweet moment of opportunity. For the scores of men and women who sought pathways to careers in law enforcement, the panic surrounding uprisings opened the door to enter police forces at unprecedented rates. Prior to King's death, the Baltimore Police Department was already trying to recruit Black officers. They even took mobile vans through Black neighborhoods, announcing their recruitment efforts via loudspeaker. They said that the vans helped raise the number of Black police officers from 6.5% in 1967 to 9% a year and a half later. Yet despite these and other efforts, Black police officers only comprised 17% of all officers, and many experienced racism, were passed over for promotions, and found themselves policing an increasingly more challenging Baltimore, as they were recruited into a war that some believed would be won on Baltimore streets, the war on drugs.
Hey, it's Dennis from Undisclosed, reminding you that Mother's Day is just around the corner. Let's be honest, we're gonna buy mom flowers, right? Yes, we are. We're gonna do it because it's the right thing to do and we know it. But let's make a promise to ourselves and to mom this year. We're not gonna get her crappy flowers. Nope. This year, we're going to get mom a beautiful artisan-designed arrangement from BloomNet. Folks, seriously, I love, love, love BloomNet. I've ordered bouquets for my mom, grandmom, and godmom because of what an awesome company BloomNet is. Two key reasons why BloomNet is great. First, BloomNet's ordering technology ensures that you're only getting flowers that were grown nearby, not flowers that were shipped in from some far-flung location. With BloomNet, you get beautiful flowers that were picked right before you order them. The second reason I love BloomNet is because there are no crappy hidden fees or surcharges. Think about your last flower ordering experience with one of those other big name flower companies. You order from them and what looks like a $30 deal turns into a $60 ripoff. That stuff does not happen with BloomNet. What you see with BloomNet is what you get. Listen, don't make your mom lie and say she loved your flowers. Use BloomNet, the flower company that doesn't cut corners. BloomNet's already a great value. They give you premium arrangements at amazing prices. But check it out. We've talked them into an exclusive offer just for our listeners and only for this week. The best price on a gorgeous bouquet, just picked, hand-designed, Instagram ready, plus a premium designer vase that cost everyone else about $15. Plus, handmade caramel treats, normally $10, but also free for our listeners. That's a huge savings, about $25, and it's the best deal they're offering. But you can only get this great deal if you first go to our page, BloomNet.com/undisclosed. This is how you can take advantage of this amazing deal. Go to BloomNet.com/undisclosed. That's BLOOMTHAT/undisclosed and find the perfect handcrafted designer flowers. You'll automatically get the free premium designer vase and caramel treats at a $20 value. Again, it's BloomNet.com/undisclosed for a premium design bouquet, free vase, and treats. don't wait. This amazing offer won't last, and it's only available to our listeners if you go to bluemat.com/undisclosed.
I think I started drinking when I was 14, and I'm still drinking.
That's a good feeling.
It's a false feeling.
You're looking at jail time anywhere from a year to 25 to 30.
When it comes to drugs, and chip stuff.
It's a temptation. It's the forbidden fruit.
Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children. From the beginning of our administration, we've taken strong steps to do something about this horror. Tonight, I can report to you that we've made much progress. 37 federal agencies are working together in a vigorous national effort. And by next year, our spending for drug law enforcement will have more than tripled from its 1981 levels. We have increased seizures of illegal drugs. Shortages of marijuana are now being reported. Last year alone, over 10,000 drug criminals were convicted, and nearly $250 million of their assets were seized by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. And in the most important area, individual use, we see progress. In 4 years, the number of high school seniors using marijuana on a daily basis has dropped from 1 in 14 to 1 in 20. The U.S. military...
You and I can help to save our life today. You can't stop a killer from reaching into minds and throwing lives away.
When President Ronald Reagan joined the First Lady to provide an important back-to-school message to the nation's parents, they painted a bleak picture of a drug-ravaged nation, where streams of crack cocaine and heroin were coming into the country and imperiling all of us as the babies, mothers, young people, and workers fell victim to addiction. Although academics, activists, and even people who served in previous presidential administrations have all exposed the terrible consequences of Reagan's decision to send the U.S. into a decidedly unwinnable war on not only drugs, but also people of color, it is important to remind ourselves how much the war on drugs enriched and shaped policing nationwide. When Reagan announced his first strategy to eliminate the threat of drugs, he characterized drug traffickers and drug dealers as part of a larger network of corruption, linking his campaign to attempts to eradicate organized crime as well as police malfeasance.
For many years, we have tolerated in America, not just in the illegal and highly dangerous drug traffic, but in many other areas, a syndicate of organized criminals whose power is now reaching unparalleled heights. The personal suffering they cause to our society in human and fiscal terms, the climate of lawlessness that its very existence fosters, has made this network of professional criminals a costly and tragic part of our history. Today, the power of organized crime reaches into every segment of our society. It is estimated that the syndicate has millions of dollars of assets in legitimate businesses. It controls corrupt union locals. It runs burglary rings. It fences for stolen goods, holds a virtual monopoly on the heroin trade. It thrives on illegal gambling, pornography, gun running, car theft, arson, and a host of other illegal activities. The existence of this nationwide criminal network and its willingness and too often its success in corrupting and gaining protection from those in high places is an affront to every law-abiding American and an encouragement to every street punk or two-bit criminal who hopes someday to make it into the big time. The reasons for the mob's success are clear. Its tactics and techniques are well known. Organization and discipline, vows of secrecy and loyalty, insulation of its leaders from direct criminal involvement, bribery and corruption of law enforcement and public officials, violence and threats against those who would testify or resist this criminal conspiracy, all have contributed to the protective curtain of silence that surrounds its activities.
Despite Reagan calling out the constellation of criminals and the public officials who helped them succeed, drug crime and drug enforcement was actually the most important and politically fruitful for the president. On that afternoon in 1982, Reagan outlined what he called a national strategy to erase the human stain of crime. He referenced a South Florida drug task force as inspiring his war strategy. Among the initiatives announced that fall day, Attorney General led task forces that would link local law enforcement with the FBI, the DEA, the IRS, the ATF, what was then called INS, the U.S. Marshals, U.S. Customs, and the Coast Guard to increase surveillance to fight crime. Reagan announced a panel of distinguished citizens who would spend 3 years analyzing organized crime so they could make the public more aware of the threat. Reagan launched a 50 states project, asking governors to get involved in criminal justice reform to reduce, not drug use, but racketeering and illegal gambling. And the Department of Justice and the Department of Treasury would offer federal level training for local police officers to stop the elements of organized crime and its link to drug trafficking. And Reagan concluded the list by saying that millions of dollars would be available for
prison and jail facilities, so that the mistake of releasing dangerous criminals because of overcrowded prisons will not be repeated. I believe this program will prove to be a highly effective attack on drug trafficking and the even larger problem of organized crime.
So how does the larger problem shift away from organized crime to drug trafficking? While Reagan was providing more dollars to law enforcement to take down drugs and the mob, he was also cutting provisions for the social safety net that he believed created an increasing lack of respect for the law. Drug education and treatment funds were cut, while monies poured in for policing equipment, including SWAT teams, and laws were passed increasing civil forfeiture capacities. Basically, property seized in raids, including cash, could be kept by local police forces. Although Richard Nixon is often credited with introducing the country to the war on drugs, in Baltimore, concerns about drugs extended all the way to Baltimore's early 20th century. In 1915, the Baltimore Police Department dispatched plainclothes officers to stop heroin from getting to Samuel Newman, an inmate who had found a way to have drugs delivered to him as he served a 2-year sentence for pickpocketing. Using old tobacco cans mailed to Newman, his friend Louise Dersch reportedly squealed on her friend after being arrested for using the mail for improper purposes. The Baltimore Sun shared the police concern about drugs in the city. Not since the wide prevalence of the cocaine traffic in Baltimore have the police been faced with a drug trade as extensive as the now flourishing in the sale of heroin. Several persons who are accused of being distributing agents of the drug have also fell into the police dragnet. It is known that a man who deals in the drug has made his headquarters on a street corner in the center of the city. He is under surveillance and his arrest is expected daily. Marshal Carter, who supervised the sting, declared, "This nefarious drug trade must be stopped. If it does not, there are some persons going to jail." Decades later, hundreds of thousands and then millions of people were headed to jail. And like their predecessors in law enforcement, Baltimore police relied on informants, watch corners, and focused their attention on certain areas of the city to prove their fitness for combat in the war on drugs. When the federal call to join the war came to Baltimore, the city was experiencing a major shift in its police department. Baltimore Police Commissioner Bishop L. Robinson became the first African American in 1984 to serve in that position, and he found himself at the center of drug enforcement in the city he had served since becoming an officer in 1952. One of his first moves to address drug crimes was to require district officers to conduct street-level drug crime investigations so that narcotics detectives could focus on what was called major operations, drug rings. By shifting officers across 9 district operational squads, Robinson said there would be a virtual narcotics unit in each district. Detectives would go after heroin, PCP, and cocaine dealers and suppliers. The squads would go after cocaine and heroin dealers, and officers in uniform would go after marijuana users and dealers. 8 officers were sent to a federal law enforcement training to learn how to seize assets from drug dealers. A police spokesperson assured that the war on drugs was going to focus on big fish. He told the Baltimore Sun in the summer of 1984, quote, "The commission is elevating the fight to the next step. Rather than arrest an individual, a low-level member of a drug organization, five times, why not take out the entire organization? So we're going to be concentrating on groups and build major cases. There are many reasons why this didn't happen, including more and more drug legislation coming out of Washington. While some major cases were being made against drugs, Baltimore leapt into the war wholeheartedly. Before Robinson had taken office, his predecessor had tripled resources for their narcotics task force. State's attorney and future mayor and future critic of the war on drugs, Kurt Schmoke, boasted a 50% increase in drug prosecutions and emphasized that he was also securing double the prison sentences than the previous administration. The FBI and the DEA brought more resources to Baltimore, but skepticism remained. Yet the war on drugs continued, and major advances, including the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, which some linked closely to the death of Len Bias, a University of Maryland basketball star who died after a cocaine overdose, continued to convince the nation that drugs were public enemy number one. In addition to the tragic loss of Bias, the war on drugs was assisted by a White House-based campaign that told kids to just say no to drugs, and yes to the growing presence of law enforcement in schools, athletic programs, and neighborhood streets. And the continued vilification of Black Americans didn't help. The president warned of excessive system abusers and reinvigorated whites to reclaim their rightful tier in the nation's hierarchy. In 1984, Baltimore City Police made 8,675 drug arrests. Among those, 6,580 were of Black people. 10 years later, 19,223 people were arrested for drug crimes. 16,869 of those were Black. Mind you, Baltimore's population had been steadily declining since 1950. Fewer people were living in Baltimore. More of them were Black, and even more people were being arrested for drug crimes. By 2010, 20,902 of Baltimore's 23,912 drug arrests were of African Americans. Baltimore did get tough on users, suspected users, those who had users in their household, non-users who held on to drugs for users, dealers, suspected dealers, people who were living, standing, breathing in places with known dealers. By the 1990s, Baltimore decided that to win the drug war, you had to adopt a policy, and that policy was called zero tolerance. I tell stories for a living, about girls in the 1940s, activists in the 1970s, and of course I tell stories on this podcast. I love stories. But for me, the hardest stories to tell are often the ones that are most important to me, the stories of my family. But I've found a new way to learn more about my family. It's fun, revealing, and simple. StoryWorth. StoryWorth sends a prompt to your loved ones each week with thought-provoking questions, questions you've never thought to ask. With StoryWorth's secure portal, your family can upload pics by email, through the web, or the easy-to-use StoryWorth app. There are no limits to the number of family members who can contribute, so invite the cousins and second cousins and all the cousins once and twice removed. You can save, edit, and enjoy the stories on StoryWorth.com. At the end of the year, you'll get all the stories bound in a beautiful hardcover printed book, which makes a perfect gift for moms, dads, and grandparents, or keep it for yourself and start working on your family archive. Strengthen your family bonds and get to know your loved ones in a whole new way. I just started my family StoryWorth, and I'm a member of a family that lives around the world, so it's nice to know we don't have to feel so far apart. And I'm learning all sorts of new stuff about what life was like for my mom when she immigrated to America and the few things she remembers about the day I was born. So whether you're celebrating Mother's Day, Father's Day, or need something special to bring to this year's reunion, StoryWorth helps you give the most valuable of all gifts, your family's history. Go to StoryWorth.com/undisclosed to receive $20 off your StoryWorth subscription.
In 2005, Time magazine named Baltimore's Martin O'Malley one of America's top five best mayors. O'Malley had ushered in a renaissance for Baltimore, they said, improving quality of life and reducing crime. A year later, Baltimore was sued by the Maryland branches of the NAACP and ACLU. O'Malley's model of zero-tolerance policing, they said, had resulted in unconstitutional and discriminatory mass arrests. In 2005, there were more than 108,000 arrests in a city of just over 600,000. To give you a snapshot of Baltimore criminal justice under zero tolerance, we spoke with Natalie Finneger, a deputy district public defender.
When Baltimore was engaging in zero tolerance or broken windows theory policing, while policies may have changed, the effects of that have continued to linger on, both within the police department and in the community. So under Martin O'Malley as mayor, there was a period of time where there were 100,000 arrests per year in Baltimore City, and there was a significantly higher percentage of cases that the state's attorney's office upon arrest would decide not even to charge. They were called release without charges. Our clients called them walkthroughs. And so they would be arrested, brought into central booking, and then about 24 or 48 hours dumped back out onto the street. And frequently they didn't even understand what had happened. And then it turns out that the way the criminal justice system was set up, they really didn't anticipate that somebody would be arrested for something by a police officer, taken and booked, and then never charged. And so the CJIS system, the place where, you know, kind of records your criminal history, would then mark no disposition received. And it looked like these cases were still open when people went to apply for jobs and went to get security clearances. I mean, we had federal employees that would come back to central booking and say, I don't understand what happened with this arrest and why it's on my record. On top of that, when you have police officers engaging with the community and, you know, locking people up for open containers, and we saw a jaywalking case, you know, and other really, really minor incidents that then turned into arrests, I think the community begins to lose faith in its policing department. And the police officers, in my opinion, seem to suffer a great deal of pressure to go out and produce arrests. And that, I think, brought apart tensions between the community and the police department.
In other cities in Maryland, Finneger says, low-level offenses like loitering and trespassing would get a citation, not make someone a criminal.
Little importance. Those two words is how a 1988 National Law Journal report describes zero tolerance. Although there are a number of critics of zero tolerance today, few realize that zero tolerance had been critiqued for a long while. In a 1988 confidential survey of 181 chief prosecutors and top narcotics deputies, 73% of respondents said that zero tolerance was not having an impact on the war on drugs. While George Bush, the elder, and his Attorney General Edwin Meese were calling for zero tolerance, for those actually prosecuting crimes, the policy shift made no sense, and it may have been as motivated by a desire to confiscate property where drugs were found, from cars to boats to houses, than to actually stop drug use. Justice Department spokesperson Deborah Buston Wade stood her ground that zero tolerance needed some time to prove that it worked. She cited Just Say No programs and death penalty sentences for drug dealers as complements to zero tolerance policies. Baltimore's state's attorney at the time, Patricia Jessamy, was skeptical. She said, "We just don't have the resources. In order to do zero tolerance right, Baltimore would need more of everything." Under Bill Clinton's administration, money to law enforcement continued to stream from the federal budget onto city streets. At some point in the 1990s, maybe with these newfound resources, Baltimore felt ready to do zero tolerance.
While Martin O'Malley was running for president in 2016, some media outlets tried to make a fresh case for the value of zero tolerance. The Daily Beast wrote, from 2000 to 2010, the incidence of crime in Baltimore dropped 43%. Well, O'Malley left office at the very beginning of 2007, so that 10-year drop was not all happening under his reign. And there are other reasons to be skeptical about crime stats in Baltimore. In his first year in office, O'Malley brought consultants from NYPD to help institute ComStat, a data management tool. Very quickly, policing in Baltimore became a hardcore numbers game. Retired NYPD detective Joseph Jacalone tells the story of CompStat.
It started in New York City in 1994 with then Commissioner William Bratton, and the mayor was Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. New York City was experiencing extreme levels of crime. We had nearly 2,400 homicides in 93. So something had to be done. Crime was out of control, and legend has it that Bill Bratton and his associates, whatever, we used to go and hang out in a place called Elaine's. Now, Elaine's was a famous bar inside Manhattan, and they would go in there and they would watch how Elaine, the owner, would handle her waitstaff and say, hey, you know, you did five tables tonight and you know, like Mary did 10, how come you only did five? And then the waiter would have to explain, well, I had a table of 20 or what have you. So they kind of like looked at this and said, hey, this is a great way to hold, our precinct commanders accountable. So they kind of stole it. That's the legend behind it. It became an accountability issue, where now police commanders were able to, you know, look at their crime that's happening within the commands and try to find out why and try to solve it. They started very crudely with the MAP program, but they were able to start examining through crime analysis about when the crimes were occurring, who they were occurring to, so basically like on days of the week, times, and they would build patterns. And then they would send out the police department to, send out the cops to go out there and stop these during this time. So it was all based on accurate and timely intelligence. I mean, that was one of the key focuses of it.
CompStat ushered in an era of data-driven policing that is still in full force, although criticized frequently. As one former BPD officer told me, stats can be juked at all levels. 6 months ago, this source, he told me the story of a gun squad that won an award for their high number of gun arrests, but that was notorious for planting guns and other shady business. He gave me names. Some of those names were among the seven cops recently federally indicted for racketeering and other crimes. The gun squad's criminal behavior was an open secret in Baltimore for years. The city had paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in settlements to the cops' victims, but the cops remained on the street. I guess they were good for stats. Data can also be juked in the other direction, by commanders, to give the impression of improvements in crime.
Because now precinct commanders are responsible or accountable for their crime, every case gets examined, 10 different ways till Sunday to see, to make sure that it is a robbery or to make sure it is a burglary or, make sure that this was a felony assault. And they would go through all the different checks to make sure. Like, years ago, it was just like, somebody said, oh, someone tried to break into my house. It was an automatic, attempted burglary. Now they want to make sure that it wasn't criminal mischief, which wouldn't be one of the, the seven major crimes that New York City follows. So everything got examined to the nth degree.
Well, it kind of sounds like a positive to me that you would want people to be careful about what really happened, right? To closely investigate.
Well, sure, but like everything else, when they started tying crime reduction to promotions, we saw a lot of captains start getting themselves in trouble. Starting to hide, crimes. We had one guy just recently in the Bronx, I think it was, he was, making complainants wait for hours on end to talk to the detectives, and they would just get fed up and leave, and then that crime would never get reported. So we've seen a number of instances where some captains have gotten themselves in trouble by, playing with the numbers, so to speak.
This was a big storyline in season 5 of The Wire. In the real-life version, according to David Simon himself, the show's creator, Martin O'Malley's path to the Maryland governorship was built on a strategic downward reclassification of charges. As Simon explained in an interview with the Marshall Project, there is no other way to account for a 15% reduction in homicide, which can't be reclassified, while other crimes were reduced by more than double that amount. Peter Moskos, a criminal justice scholar, and author of the book Cop in the Hood about 2 years as a BPD patrol officer, reacted to Simon's interview by saying this: when it comes to crime stats, I only really trust homicides.
let's start by looking at murders. Under Martin O'Malley, for the first time in years, the murder rate dropped just below 300. The natural conclusion is that more arrests lead to fewer murders. Then, O'Malley's successor disproved this. In 2007, Mayor Sheila Dixon put in place a new police commissioner, Frederick Bielefeld III, who stepped back from zero-tolerance policing. Steadily, the department made fewer and fewer arrests, to 45,000 in 2010. That year, for the first time on record, the murder rate also dropped below 200, a historic moment for the city. Fewer arrests, in that case, led to fewer murders. When you talk to police officers that have worked in Baltimore, they consistently refer to the Bielefeld era as a golden age. Crime was improving, cops were conducting fewer meaningless arrests, and they had a sense of purpose. Bad guys with guns, Bielefeld constantly said in his trademark colloquial style.
You know, my sense is that Commissioner Bielefeld had spent a significant amount of time in Baltimore, really understood the force, really understood, you know, kind of where some of the skeletons were hidden. Yeah. And, you know, he was able to rally the officers and institute a little bit of a cultural change. And I think that was a great strength that he had in the position, yeah. You know. And I think you're right that the officers' morale increased dramatically. I mean, we were still seeing some really significant training issues and Fourth Amendment problems. But obviously, with the zero tolerance changing, you know, that kind of changed things a bit for the officers.
Bielefeld was white and had spent his entire career at BPD. He had few political enemies. He remained as commissioner for 5 years, a refreshing break after the high turnover of the O'Malley era, which saw three commissioners, two transplanted from New York. Nominally, Bielefeld was restoring an image of BPD doing community policing. Internally, however, the department shifted its focus away from patrol officers or beat cops to specialized units. This shift was already beginning to take place under O'Malley. A young African-American lieutenant named Tony Barksdale, mentored by Commissioner Ed Norris, was given a chance to lead a squad focused on gun arrests. This evolved into the city's organized crime division. Barksdale pushed back against O'Malley, emphasizing targeted over random arrests, quality over quantity, investigating case files over numbers alone. If this doesn't sound enough like an episode of The Wire, his squad also employed wiretaps, undercover sting operations, and plainclothes officers, which were deployed flexibly. The public knows these plainclothes officers as jump-out boys or knockers. They burst out of unmarked vehicles and rough up civilians without warning. It has been said that uniformed officers deter crime, but plainclothes officers catch criminals. At 35 years old, Barksdale became Bielefeld's deputy commissioner of operations, the youngest ever deputy in the city's history. His specialized unit was expanded citywide, becoming the Violent Crime Impact Section, or VCIS, located in several districts. He oversaw other specialized units. By 2010, as one former VCIS detective described it, patrol was no longer the backbone of Baltimore policing. New officers with any level of ambition were trying to get placed onto specialty squads. Barksdale has been described positively as the yang to Commissioner Bielefeld's yin. They were the street enforcer and the community builder. Homicides reduced, the clearance rate improved, but story after story also came out about VCIS and other plainclothes detectives engaged in corruption, brutality, juking stats, and more, like the seven indicted officers. A former VCIS cop explained what happened to lead to these issues. When Barksdale's model was expanded citywide, he suddenly needed bodies to fill all of those squads. Not all of the selected officers had the experience or integrity to do sophisticated policing. Some, not all, of the squads became corrupted by the power and freedom inherent in how they operated. Across the country, plainclothes squads had become a popular approach. Lately, they are being disbanded. What started as an intelligence-based focus model of policing ended up producing too many cowboys and gangs. Gang is the appropriate word. A 2013 Los Angeles Times article described one jumper squad getting matching tattoos. In 2010, Bielefeld briefly suspended VCIS to address some of these concerns. Soon it was relaunched with a new name, VCID, Violent Crime Impact Division, not Section. It would be renamed one more time before it was finally shut down by Commissioner Davis earlier this year. It's been a hard habit for Baltimore to break.
The late 2000s under Commissioner Bielefeld was marked by crime reduction and the end of zero tolerance, but also by underlying issues with brutality and corruption bubbling to the surface. Political pressure forced a changing of the guard. After Stephanie Rawlings Blake was elected mayor, Bielefeld retired. The yang to his yin, Deputy Commissioner Tony Barksdale, was named acting commissioner. The rank and file were excited about his leadership. He was one of them. He came from West Baltimore. He was a strong leader, and he was willing to be an iconoclast. But Barksdale wasn't media savvy or politically smooth. The mayor and her allies decided to go in another direction. They picked out someone from the West Coast, a former commissioner with a PhD, who spoke the language of accountability and reform, and had the support of leaders like William Bratton from New York, one of the architects of Comstat. Little did they know that Anthony Batts had been dealing with scandals and serious questions about his leadership and character in two different cities in California, or that he had been driven out of both before landing in Baltimore. In 2012, Baltimore Sun reporter Justin Fenton traveled to Long Beach, where Anthony Batts started his career. Fenton was investigating rumors about corruption and domestic violence. The article he published and the ones that followed were very soft on Batts. They were filled with quotes like, "Tony Batts is one of the best there is in American policing today, provided by Batts' colleagues and friends." And then there would be a very brief passing mention of a scandal or two. I made the same journey to Long Beach that Fenton made recently. I talked to police officers, journalists, girlfriends, activists, who all had a lot to say about Tony Batts. Not much positive. I also contacted a few people in Oakland. Only two of these sources are willing to go on the record about Batts, out of fear of what they describe as his retaliatory nature. We hinted at Batts' less than ethical side in episode one. We captured him whispering and giggling to the mayor at a press conference the day after Freddie Gray died about cameras he didn't want to turn over to the state's attorney. I'm not sure why Fenton chose to tell the story he told, exalting Batts, instead of sharing more of the other side. Some of it depended on anonymous sources, although The Sun uses anonymous police sources regularly. More than that, some of it is accessible through court documents. A former close advisor of Batts shared one memorable conversation she had with Justin Fenton just after Batts took over in Baltimore. She leaned across the table to Fenton and warned him, "I promise you this, there will be some kind of major corruption or scandal with Tony soon. And when it happens, you could call me, and I will say, I told you so." Anthony Batts came up, as they say, in the Long Beach Police Department. In 2002, he was named its youngest police chief ever, and only its second black chief. Batts was a great chief on paper. He had a doctorate in public administration. He wrote his dissertation on the use of police force. He listened to experts. But he was something else in reality for many Long Beach officers and citizens.
I found Tony Batts to be very arrogant, egocentric, self-centered, a bully, extremely clever politically.
That's Tracy Wilson Kleekamp, a Long Beach community activist who took an interest in investigating the truth about Batts.
I think when he was in among community member people, or people that challenged or questioned him, he didn't like that, but he had to ingratiate himself to the city manager and the council people because those are the people that he answered to. So he was more interested in them than us, the constituents. I personally don't think that the people who were in charge of him held him to very high standards.
Batts left Long Beach before his 10-year contract ended, while he was still in the midst of Lobstergate, a 2008 lawsuit filed against the city of Long Beach and Batts by three police officers who claimed adverse employment actions, including unrelenting retaliation for whistleblowing. 4 years before, two of these officers spoke up about some other cops working the late-night shift at the port. They found evidence of illegal diving for lobsters, falsifying time cards, and more. In exchange for speaking out, the cops were called snitches, stuffed lobsters were left on their desks, their property was vandalized, they were physically intimidated, and they were denied opportunities by Batts for transfers, advancement, or overtime. A sergeant who supported them was compelled into an early disability retirement over a bad knee. He joined the lawsuit. The night shift officers were protected, receiving only transfers and letters of reprimand. The whistleblowers won their lawsuit. The city paid them $4.1 million total. Batts took the stand. He claimed that the plaintiffs were average employees, despite written evaluations to the contrary. Just after this case, a small local independent paper called the Long Island Beachcomber started printing anonymously sourced stories about Batts. They reported that one of the night shift cops had been blackmailing Batts with knowledge of a cover-up of his own alleged violence against women. I heard about Batts' record of abuse from other sources, including cops, who heard it called out on the radio. I hesitated to discuss these allegations without proof, but the stories are detailed and corroborating. The Beachcomber also printed letters to the editor, written by cops who provided their names and confirmed these accounts. Tracy Wilson Kleep remembers looking into this story on her own.
Behind the scenes, there were people inside City Hall and the police department that were talking about him quite a bit. They knew I was snooping around. I was at a community meeting one night, and an officer came up to me in plain clothes and said, "I just want you to know that there wasn't any domestic violence going on because I went on the call, and there was no domestic violence when I went on the call." And I'm thinking, okay, you just told on yourself. You're telling me that you went on a domestic violence call, and you're denying that anything happened. I just walked away from the guy. It just didn't add up.
I also met with the Beachcomber publisher, Jay Beeler, who talked on the record about Batts.
People came out of the woodwork to tell me about the corruption going on in the police department. Tell me about Batts. Tell me about Lobstergate. Tell me the whole background. So suddenly I've gone from just being a little podunk paper in Long Beach to being an authority on Tony Batts, because I started writing about it. And the first story that appeared was in July of 2009, where we talk about Lobstergate. At about that time, I had enough information about his domestic violence background. I started to ask at City Hall for his personnel records and any documentation with respect to the domestic violence, but that was not forthcoming. But I had plenty of sources telling me all of the background.
There was one aspect of the discussion around Batts that sometimes made me uncomfortable. It's like in one of the Beachcomber articles, it referred to Batts getting his position because he was black, with the subtitle, "Black Chief Wanted." Anthony Batts's blackness comes up among his Long Beach haters, who aren't all white, by the way. But still, I had to explore the possibility that this might be a bigoted smear campaign. I asked Tracy about this.
When Tony Batts first became the chief, I remember thinking, okay, they have a crappy department. They have poor race relations, and so they're going to get a black chief. So that lets the white folks off the hook for the mess that they've made. And what I mean is the white folks who are in power, in charge, they were not going to admit that they had allowed these kind of problems to go on. I mentioned to you a book, Brutal Justice, talks about the history of Long Beach's police department's horrible race relations. Actually, when I started looking into Tony and paying attention, I went and got this book. I was really interested in how long and how deep the bad behavior of the police department went. So it's long and deep. So in their mind, hey, this is good. We're going to get a black police chief. We can just wash our hands of this and let him take care of it, right? In my mind, he was Long Beach's Clarence Thomas.
In the middle of the Lobstergate scandal, Batts was named temporary city manager of Long Beach to fill a vacancy. The city manager is actually the boss of the commissioner. Someone else had to fill his vacancy as chief of police. The city council approved this, claiming that it would help Batts grow. This was strange. Their reasoning wasn't very clear. Insiders told me that it had to do with the city not wanting to break Batz's 10-year contract, but still wanting him out. In one of Fenton's cushy pieces on Batz, he shares why Batz left Long Beach to become chief of the Oakland Police Department, because he was moved by the killing of four Oakland police officers and wanted to help out. If this sounds a little too on the nose, I learned from a Batz advisor that the story was invented to cover up for Batz being pushed out of Long Beach. Batz became the Oakland police chief in 2009. It didn't go well. Halfway through a three-year contract, Batz secretly applied for a job leading the San Jose Police Department. Apparently, he hated Oakland. As a local reporter discovered, investigating his calendar, he was constantly leaving town, cutting short his days and weeks to go back to Long Beach. San Jose rejected Batz, but the Oakland mayor found out about the application and was just about to fire him. Instead, he publicly resigned, breaking his contract. As reported by Justin Fenton in the Baltimore Sun, Batz blamed the Oakland mayor for a challenging relationship, and he blamed the federal government for the demands of working under a consent decree. The Sun quoted more of Batz's friends justifying this move. "Oakland was a mess," one said. "Batz got screwed," the other said. Police chief, two big cities in only a few years, two odd departures, two broken contracts. Here is where my sources started having questions for me.
My question was, does anybody do background checks on these people? Does anybody have any concerns about lawsuits that they have, civil actions against them, you know, allegations of domestic violence? Do they check out any of this stuff? And so that's what worried me.
I don't know why Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake hired Batz or the city council supported it. He was charming, well-educated, progressive on paper. He had just attended a leadership program briefly at Harvard. I only know that the locals in Baltimore weren't told much about his baggage. His moving around that much alone should have been a red flag, according to Peter Moskos.
I don't see this great track record he talks about. Where was his great success? He career jumped, he went in places, implemented changes, and then left, you know, called victory and moved on. Those sort of career hopping police commissioners, I'm very skeptical of.
That's interesting. That's a thing.
I mean, say what you want about Barksdale, like, that man's committed to Baltimore. You know, that is without doubt. And that counts for something. Doesn't mean what he's saying is right. I mean, I think most of what he says is right, but like, there's something about that. This guy cares about Baltimore. He's not just worth thinking about his next career move.
But what you're saying is interesting, because most of the conversation I've had around Batz has been like his particular bad leadership style or the fact that he was an outsider. But I hadn't thought about it from the point of view of like looking at the way, hey, certain priests are getting transferred a lot. What's up with that, you know? So I never thought about how there might be a class of police leaders who kind of jump around the country. And then
And they tend to be part of the progressive strain, by the way, which you could jump around and not have a certain ideology, but it tends to be that. I think the more conservative cops tend to stay a little more rooted. I mean, Arpaio isn't going to run for sheriff in another county, I don't think, for instance.
Not exactly, no.
Yeah, and there's a little network of, you know, so-called reformers who pat themselves on the back and you know, get invited to academic conferences because they're on the left side of political issues.
When Batz took over as commissioner in 2012, he promised the public a lot.
The most important promises that I made to the citizens of Baltimore were the police department would be as transparent as it could be, and we would serve this community in the way this community dictates. Those promises are genuine, and I intend to carry them out.
This was from a press conference in 2014 after Batz had been commissioner for a couple years. He was grilled about the lack of apparent progress. It would take time, he said. He had created task forces and commissions and brought in well-paid consultants like William Bratton, who had supported his hire. If things weren't progressing quickly enough, it wasn't his fault. The big problems preceded him.
What particularly, in your opinion, is the problem with the department in terms of the public's perception?
I think for many years, this organization in the public has the distance has been exasperated over the years. You can see it through Mark Puente's report from those cases from 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010. But it stops. It stops now. And what I've been brought here to do is to build those relationships, to reform this organization, and that's what we're doing.
Batts did make some changes at Baltimore, although mostly cosmetic. He said that he was disbanding the plainclothes jumper squad, VCID. He actually just moved the officers into two new squads where they performed basically the same functions. As proof of this, current Commissioner Kevin Davis recently announced the actual disbanding of those squads, sending more than 100 plainclothes officers back into patrol. So what did Batts actually do? He did institute one major change that was impactful a month before Freddie Gray's death. He changed the way that patrol officers work, following the advice of some academic consultants. Instead of working 5 8-hour shifts per week, they would now work 4 10-hour overlapping shifts. And he also did away with posts, that radius of blocks that patrol officers claim as their own, as their beats. Instead, Batts had them work more broadly in sectors. This may have been a budgetary decision, or maybe he wanted to encourage flexibility, but it's a decision that many say was disastrous and contributed to increased crime. At the least, it was a sharp move away from proactive community policing. When Kevin Davis took over the department after Batts was fired, he reversed many of Batts' changes almost immediately, including instituting a return to posts. True to form, Batts turned off the rank and file in Baltimore quickly. In another Fenton story, Batts described seeing on the streets of Baltimore drugs being exchanged inside of a red balloon. Drugs are not exchanged in balloons in Baltimore. That's a West Coast thing. This, to the Baltimore police force, indicated that Batts was not honest. Batts continued to impose his West Coast experience on Baltimore. He spoke frequently about gang threats. He blamed the Black Guerrilla Family, or BGF, for rising crime. He failed to understand how the drug trade worked in the city at that time, when gangs were more prominent in prisons than on streets. Even state officials questioned his claims about BGF. On the day of Freddie Gray's funeral, BPD issued a statement that the police received a, quote, credible threat that several gangs were planning on taking out police officers. This false claim, credited to a compromised source, led to an FBI investigation and forced BPD's media spokesperson to resign, or, as the Sun reported, willingly leave the force after 13 years to start a consulting business. Okay. From the beginning, Batts did not try to fight the appearance of being an outsider in Baltimore. After he was hired in 2012, he brought on Jerry Rodriguez from Los Angeles to run his new Division of Accountability and Professional Standards. And he brought on Kevin Davis from Prince George's County to oversee operations. Police officers critical of Batts say that this was a power move. He was bringing in people that would have to be loyal to him. Even though Batts never successfully established the power he had in Long Beach in Baltimore, he did import one key habit: retaliating against decent cops. There are several prominent examples, but the one that got the most attention involved a VCID detective named Joe Crystal, who blew the whistle on excessive force in his squad. This was Crystal speaking with Joy Reid on MSNBC in January 2015.
What happened on the day of the incident that you wound up reporting to your superiors?
Well, ma'am, I was working at the time as a detective in Baltimore City, and I observed a sergeant and an off-duty officer assault a handcuffed suspect. To me, ma'am, I'm not okay with something like that. So I reported it to supervisors within my chain of command in my unit to follow the chain of command. I was told specifically, you know, not to quote unquote rat or snitch. And my attempts to report it basically fell on deaf ears, or did fall on deaf ears. And after that, I went directly to prosecutors to report this to a prosecutor. Actually, when I was even off to let them know what happened. I assisted in the investigation at that point. The officer and the sergeant were indicted, charged, tried, and the one officer was, both of them were found guilty. One officer was sentenced to 45 days in jail. The other officer was given probation for their roles in the incident.
But now, so once those officers were indeed found guilty and it turned out that you were right, that what you said happened indeed happened, did you get support from other members of the department or from your superiors?
No, ma'am, not at all. It was very rough, ma'am. You know, I had to deal with calling for backup or calling for a unit to, you know, come help me. You know, as an officer, ma'am, you can't do everything on your own. You need the help of the people you work with to back you up and keep you safe and just assist in you know, supporting the citizens. And I would call for backup on multiple times and nobody came. I had a supervisor call me and threaten me and tell me I better pray to God I'm not the star witness. You spoke yourself, ma'am, about the rat that was put on mine and my wife's car. I even had a supervisor have me or try to tempt me to forge a document that I refused to do. So, I mean, I had no type of support whatsoever.
Is there a culture that says to officers, it's more important to stay loyal to your fellow officers, even if they're doing something wrong, than for you to come forward?
Well, ma'am, I know police try to view themselves as a family. And unfortunately, you know, I bought into that and hoped that, like you said, officers would come and support me. And unfortunately, Baltimore City had more of a, I guess, a gang mentality or a dysfunctional family mentality instead. And they basically were against me for speaking out against other officers. I even had our FOP union rep said to me at one time, you know, people are upset with you because this is blood in and blood out. And I guess that's the type of culture that, you know, they have there.
If this story sounds familiar, maybe you heard it on the news. Or maybe it sounds almost exactly like Lobstergate. In fact, Crystal did file a lawsuit against the department. Bats claimed to be supportive, to want to get to the bottom of things. Transparency, accountability, he said. Only then, Bats's people initiated an investigation into Crystal for an unrelated matter, an accident in a take-home vehicle while his wife was in the car. The department claimed this was in violation of a general order, although the order, which is older, isn't totally clear. Ultimately, Crystal resigned from the force and signed a settlement agreement with the city. He would no longer speak to the press about his story, provided that the investigation against him was dropped. So much for transparency and accountability. The next day, after Crystal resigned, Bat sent out a new general order, a revised take-home car policy. Even after a few years in Baltimore, Bats continued to operate as if he floated above the reality of the city, his imagination sometimes reinforced by his friends at the Sun. When crime spiked after the riots, Bats said it was because pills were stolen from the burned-down CVS and had flooded the market. The feds knew otherwise. He later offered a different reason. The cops were taking a knee, refusing to work, in defiance of his leadership. It wasn't his fault. Crime did spike enormously that spring and has yet to die back down. Homicides increased by 150% just after the April 27th riot. 2016 was Baltimore's second deadliest year on record. Shootings have also more than doubled. One BPD source explained the taking a knee theory. There was no organized resistance. It's that Baltimore cops no longer have any idea what they're supposed to do. Just before the April 27th riots, Bats told all the officers in riot gear not to engage at all with the rioters, even if they were attacked, even if they throw rocks on you or spit on you, he said. Bats at first denied that he said this, but then he told the Sun that it was for their own protection. Then, just after the riots, he blamed the officers for not doing their jobs, for taking a knee. Then, he apologized to the Fraternal Order of Police for blaming Freddie Gray's death on cop behavior. Then, he told the media that he never apologized to anyone. The double talk was becoming dizzying. There are a lot of possible reasons for the recent crime spike in Baltimore, including more organized gangs. But when crime spikes that much, practically overnight, according to Peter Moskos, you can't blame socioeconomic factors or crime trends. The real issue is leadership.
And look, the problems are tough. Great leadership, but, you know, it's not that everything could be solved if only there was some great leader in charge. But incompetent leadership has consequences. And what I found I found many things frustrating in the wake of Freddie Gray's death and the riots and the DOJ report. But one of them was the complete failure of leadership in Baltimore to take responsibility for anything. It all fell down to these, you know, cops on the street who are trying to do the best they can by and large. But, you know, this is not some rogue banana republic force running. I mean, you have a police commissioner. Cops follow orders. You have a mayor who appoints the police commissioner. That is where the leadership is needed. And some of that, you know, does and should and will trickle down. But for the leaders to sort of throw up their hands and go, oh my gosh, we don't know what's going on in this city is both disingenuous and it's painful to listen to because it's just a sign of utter failure on their part.
Mayor Rawlings Blake fired Anthony Batts on July 10th, 2015, with a $150,000 severance package and payment for unused leave. Batts moved to South Florida. He now provides training around the country on police leadership.
In August of 2014, when unrest broke out in Ferguson, Missouri, after Officer Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown, some observers noted that despite the fact that Ferguson's population is two-thirds black, the city government and the police force was virtually all white. But Baltimore was different, right? It was governed mostly by African Americans, with black leadership overseeing schools, occupying City Hall, and at the head of the police department. Freddie's death opens up an important discussion about the limits of black faces in high places. Scholars like Princeton University's Kianga Yamada Taylor caution concerned citizens against thinking that racial representatives means racial justice. She points out in her book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, that at the very moment African Americans were winning elections in major cities, from Cleveland to Los Angeles and Chicago in the late 1960s and beyond, cities were also losing critical federal funds, support for infrastructure and jobs, and where blacks were subjected to increasing poverty, deteriorating schools, and the most aggressive policing tactics. So the racist policies and practices that shaped Freddie Gray's life and death could have happened in a number of U.S. cities. And the response to his death was as predictable in the streets of Baltimore as Brown's death in the avenues of Ferguson. The question we have to ask ourselves, how do we make sure justice is colorblind when our laws, our courts, and our policing was designed to maintain the color line?
Comprehensive lay of the Baltimore Police Department land and understand its history and leadership, we have to zoom in closer. Closer to examine who Freddie Gray was in the eyes of the law and who the police officers charged with his death are. Next time on Undisclosed.
Undisclosed, the Killing of Freddie Gray, episode 9, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marsha Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode, Meethal Telhan produced, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Our great sponsors this week were BloomNet and Storyworth. Make sure y'all do the right thing this Mother's Day and get mom some quality, freshly cut flowers from BloomNet and do a story with her with Storyworth. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Also, Undisclosed won a Webby for our music. Yeah, Patrick, you rock. You totally deserve this award. Thank you. Thank you to all of our listeners for voting as well. Nina Musser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. For discussion about this week's episode, follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag FreddieGray and or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then.